You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Welcome to the program, A Good Book. This is the third part of the book, Late for the Bus, an adoption story, Finding My Birth Parents, Jerry and Joanne Buss. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close, and I am also the author of the book. This is the true story of finding my birth parents after years of fruitless searching, only to discover that I am the eldest daughter of Dr. Gerald Buss, the multimillionaire, legendary owner of the Los Angeles Lakers, and his wife, Joanne. On the previous broadcast, Jimmy and Maddie, my adoptive parents, met, fell in love, and married, purchased a home, and later discovered they were unable to have children. They adopted their first child in 1948, and 5 years later, adopted their second child, excited to share the news with friends of their new baby girl with the big brown eyes. The story continues with the moment their lives changed, when Jimmy had a nervous breakdown and was unable to return to work. We ended last week with the move to Waco, Texas. We now begin 1960-1961, second grade, Phoenix, Arizona. We left summer in Waco behind and arrived in Phoenix. My parents rented an apartment in the center of the city on Van Buren Street, near Central Avenue. The apartment complex was a one-story building made of red brick with a Bermuda grass courtyard, shade trees, and a breeze block fence. It was a cool place to play outside in the hot and dry climate of our new town. But we didn't stay long and rented a house on the west side of town after the start of the school year. I entered second grade a bit late. Alhambra Grade School was an old mission-style building with huge red-painted concrete steps leading up to the main entrance. After being escorted to the classroom and introduced to the teacher, I felt embarrassed walking to my empty, unassigned desk. The other students were already busy with their own little cigar box filled with the required list, 2 pencils, a pink eraser, and a set of crayons in 8 colors. It's funny how little, seemingly unimportant images find a place to live in the back of your mind. For some reason, my teacher often misspelled my name. My parents were from the South, where children, both boys and girls, were often given the middle name of Lee in honor of the Confederate General Robert E. Lee. In the South, many are called by both their first and middle name. My mother's name was Meta Lee, so Lee became my first name. But no one I knew, and I mean no one, had a first name like mine. It was uncommon, especially for a girl. And so my name was often misspelled as L-E-I-G-H or L-E-A. That's when I began to daydream about what my real name might be. 1961 was the last year for Alhambra Grade School to hold classes, and it eventually became a storage yard for district school buses. Christine was already at the new grade school, Madrid, for her 7th grade class. I was enjoying this new Arizona adventure, but I miss my Aunt Faye back in California. I wrote a letter to her on October 25, 1960. Dear Aunt Faye, I miss you and the two others. I can come and see you. School is Alhambra, and I like it. My room number is 39. My teacher is Miss Simpson. Good for now. The two others were my uncle and my cousin. My teacher's name should have been spelled Mrs. Simpson. I guess I got even by misspelling her name. I also meant to write goodbye for now on the last line. A 3-line letter from a 7-year-old can be quite revealing. Living in Phoenix felt free and fresh. Blue skies and big white fluffy clouds. I love school. And I love second grade. I was introduced to classical music with the Music Memory Contest, During class, the teacher would play certain parts of classical pieces on a record player and talk about each one. Students would listen and be tested on what they had learned. During the formal music memory contest, music would be played and the student had to identify the piece and the composer via multiple choice. If you achieved a certain percentage correct, you received a music memory award certificate. Those with the highest percentages were invited to hear live music performed by a symphony orchestra. I qualified, and our special concert was held at the Westward Ho, a fine hotel that my father's heroes, President Kennedy and Vice President Johnson, would visit that same year. Seeing and hearing a symphony orchestra for the first time was beyond impressive to this little girl. Summer of 1961, a visit to Southgate, California. For vacation, we drove to Southgate, California to visit my grandmother, my aunt, and uncle. My sister, almost a teenager now, would stay up at the front house with Grandma, and I would stay at the back house with Aunt Faye and Uncle George. In the afternoons, my aunt would hum melodies as she puttered around the house, getting ready for my uncle to come home. Around 3:30, she would take a shower, pile her beautiful silver-white hair up in a bun, put on a nice flowery dress, and dab White Shoulders perfume on her neck. She was a good cook and prepared meals on a tiny antique gas stove with a working clock. My job was to set the table and fold the napkins a certain way. Because my mother worked most nights, we didn't have as many opportunities to eat dinner as a family. But here in Southgate, dinner was served at nearly the same time every evening. The meal often included food unfamiliar to me, especially the vegetables, but I was encouraged to at least take one bite of anything on my plate. I learned how to say yuck silently and not make a face, and I would sneak bites of food under the table to give to their wiener dog, Duchess. After dinner, I would stand on a two-step stool and wash the dishes. My cousin was already away at college, so I slept in his bedroom, often pretending to be asleep, so I could hear the Johnny Carson show full strength from the tiny portable television on the kitchen table. My aunt stayed up late to watch, but my uncle usually went to bed around 8 p.m. because he got up at 4 a.m. to go to work. When our family returned to Phoenix after our stay in Southgate, we were greeted with terrible news. We lost Laddie, our black cocker spaniel. Our neighbors had been taking care of our animals while we were in California. Laddie was my sister's dog. I asked her recently about it. She thought Laddie may have died of distemper because he had not gotten his shots. She wrote, "I will never forget that summer because as soon as we got out of the car, our neighbor girl, Susie, yelled out, 'Hey, your dog died,' which made me cry." Christine, a retired registered nurse, rescues dogs and cats now, usually too many at one time. She would have been an excellent vet. Many canines and felines have benefited from her good graces and continue to do so. In September of 1961, near Santa Monica, California, my biological parents, Jerry and Joanne Buss, gave birth to their second daughter, Jeannie. I now had three full siblings, Johnny, Jimmy, and Jeannie. 1961-1962, third grade, Phoenix, Arizona. For my third grade year, we continued living in Phoenix, but rented a different home a few miles away. I entered Madrid grade school, where my sister was now an eighth grader. This was my third school in 3 years. Our new home had three bedrooms and a big backyard surrounded by a redwood slat fence and featured a large mulberry tree that was easy to climb. In the dry desert environment, Dad would water the lawn often, attaching his Rainbird sprinkler to the hose and adjusting the spray in a half circle. It made a timely sound, chuck, 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 while rotating slowly around the yard. I would jump back and forth over the water for hours. It was easy to get as tan as a coffee bean in the Arizona sun. Mom always allowed me to choose which bedroom would be mine. We would hang my white cotton eyelet curtains with the lavender trim that we carried from home to home. This immediately personalized my bedroom and made it feel like our home. Dad had not gone back to work yet and stained a 6-drawer pine dresser for me, which was the perfect place for my fishbowl and hamster cage. Animals were a constant in our family, and we usually had a cat or two and a dog and some guppies or goldfish, a hamster, and some parakeets. I was always asking for a new pet and found a way to get a new kitten for free from a local pet shelter. The building was close by, and I would often ride my bike over there. But I had spotted a freezer on the back property, and it frightened me to think what might be in it. A few days later, as someone was coming in to drop off a litter, I intercepted and told them my mom said I could have one. I always carried a box with a lid in my basket for just such an occasion. I put the kitten in the box, closed the lid, and with one hand on top of the box and the other on the handlebars, wobbled all the way home. I told my mom I found the kitten, which was partly true. She never questioned me. We kept the kitten. When my dad was feeling better, he would take my sister and me to play golf at Black Canyon Golf Course, a little 9-hole course in Phoenix, just off the I-17 freeway. My sister showed interest and talent. She could putt like a champion, but often got frustrated. I would tag along, and when I got older, I started playing golf too. Golf was the only sport my dad took in any interest in at all, so it was something we could share as a family. This was a happy time for me, but third grade was also the year I overheard my teacher speak of me as being adopted. Prior to that time, I pretended Mom and Dad were my real parents, but from this point on, I no longer tried to convince myself or anyone else that I look like my adoptive mom. I was only 9, and she was now 47 years old. On some days, I was embarrassed that she was my mother, and her clothes were so old-fashioned. She worked nights, so I didn't have to worry about my school friends asking, "Is that your grandmother?" at the open house events. Sometimes I felt guilty about it, but I often wondered about my real parents. How old are they? What do they look like? Are they nice people? Do I have any real brothers and sisters? If they found me, would they want me to go and live with them? Sometimes I wondered if God had anything to do with this. Mom and Dad were non-church-going Southern Baptists. They read the Bible at home and quoted it quite comfortably and regularly. One day, Christine asked me if I wanted to go to a Catholic church with our neighbor. Our parents did not object, so off we went. St. Vincent de Paul was the most magnificent building I had ever seen, inside or out. A big, beautiful church built of gray concrete block with a sharply angled roof that soared to the sky. Outside the church, wide wooden overhangs protected the perimeter, making the outside corridors shady and cool. The pastor, Father John O'Malley Sharp, CM, 1911 to 2003, was a tall, red-headed man who wore a black cassock. From the first time I attended Mass, I was awestruck by the priest's beautifully embroidered vestment, the smell of incense, the ringing of 3 little bells, and the sound of Latin. Dominus vobiscum, the Lord be with you, et cum spiritu tuo, and with your spirit. The Mass was mysterious to me. It was also inspiring. My sister and I attended Saturday catechism classes. I learned the responses in Latin. I learned the prayers and the rosary. I learned about the Blessed Mother. I studied the saints, the feasts, and I learned about Jesus a second time. The first time was back in Southgate, where my mother taught Bible school for a short time at the local Baptist church. My sister and I attended Mass on Easter Sunday in April, and in May 1962, we were baptized in the faith and joined St. Vincent de Paul, our new local parish church. For me, being Catholic was more interesting than being a Baptist. Christine wasn't so sure. It was a good thing that my sister and I had several distractions like church and school. Dad had fallen ill again. He had been in the hospital for several weeks that spring, continuing his tug-of-war with the Railroad Retirement Board requesting sickness benefits. Mom wrote a letter to the board on April 7, 1962, which stated in part, "Jim has been confined to Maryvale Community Hospital in Phoenix. The date of release from the hospital is unknown and indefinite." You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close, and we are reading from the book Late for the Bus on the program A Good Book. The Railroad Board replied with the requirement of a completed doctor's statement on the form they supplied. Their final reply was dated April 25, 1962. Dad had finally convinced the board of his financial need. That being said, I have included the entire body of the confirmation letter because anyone who has had to battle with the corporate America over sickness benefits should read this confusing letter. Skip it if it bores you or makes you dizzy. "The medical information we have received indicates that you are still unable to work within the meaning of the Railroad Unemployment Insurance Act. Accordingly, you are entitled to sickness benefits beginning July 1, 1961. However, we have received information from our headquarters office that your annuity under the Railroad Retirement Act was recertified on September 22, 1961, increasing it from $131.90 to $138.80. This increase was retroactive to May 11, 1960. We have also been advised that on February 14, 1962, your annuity was recertified for the month of May 1961 when it was determined that your earnings were not excessive. Since benefits paid under the Railroad Unemployment Insurance Act are payable only in the amount such benefits exceed the amount of your annuity, the increase in your annuity has resulted in an overpayment of sickness benefits you received for the day November 9, 1960 through May 16, 1961. This overpayment amounts to $11.43. Our records show that we previously paid you sickness benefits of $569.80 for the above period. Because of the increase in your annuity, you were entitled to receive $457.37. The apportionable amount of sickness benefits payable to you for the days July 1, 1961 through January 5, 1962 is $469.45. We are using part of this amount to recover the $112.43 you owe us. You should receive a check within a few days for the balance of $357.02. With the payment of $357.02, you will have been paid all the sickness benefits allowable in your case. Benefits paid to a claimant may not be more than his base year earnings or 130 times his daily benefit rate, whichever is less. A new benefit year begins on July 1st. You may be qualified for benefits in the new benefit year if your railroad earnings were at least $500 during 1961. This does not include earnings over $400 for any month. If you are unable to work and wish to claim sickness benefits in the new benefit year beginning July 1, 1962, you must file another application and statement of sickness, forms S11A and B. These forms should be filled out and mailed not later than July 7th. You may lose benefits if the forms are mailed late. Who could make sense of a letter like that? I guess it didn't matter, because it was a relief knowing that some extra money would be coming in for my dad. Mom continued to hold up the household with the income she made as a waitress, and again as parents, they were always in sync. Throughout my childhood, I never saw them fight or even raise their voices. Mom always had a smile and a gentle touch. The only time I can remember being spanked was when she used a fly swatter on my leg once or twice. I don't even remember what I did to deserve it. I think it hurt her more than me. I just kept thinking about the dead fly parts on the surface as she swatted me. Summer of 1962, a visit to Southgate, California. I spent most of my summer in Southgate. Aunt Faye was a homemaker and could spend most of the day with me. Uncle George was a truck driver who drove an intrastate route for Western Gillette. After my grandfather passed away, my grandmother rented out the small apartment on her property to make extra money. My sister, a quiet, shy young lady, enjoyed the peacefulness of staying at the front house with our grandmother. I loved staying in the back house with my aunt and uncle. In one corner of their living room sat an old upright piano, painted antique grass green with a flower design etched into the wood. The piano had real ivory keys, but middle C was missing, and nearby keys were yellowed with dark stains in the cracks, which made it easy for a beginner to find the correct finger placement. My aunt and I learned how to play the piano together. Her teacher preferred the Michael Aaron piano series, and after each formal lesson, Aunt Faye would come home and teach me what she had learned that day. She was also a good seamstress. She had a beautiful black electric Singer sewing machine with gold-painted embellishments on it. She made fancy clothes for my Barbie doll, who had quickly tired of her black and white stretch swimsuit and slip-on shoes. My Barbie was blonde, just like me, and we played for hours in the backyard garden, surrounded by pink carnation plants and red rose bushes that my grandmother had lovingly grown in the rich, dark soil, so unlike the light brown dirt in Phoenix. Short in stature, my uncle had a big nose like Jimmy Durante and wore his hair in a crew cut. On weekends, he wore old, worn-out jeans and a plaid flannel shirt. He had a wood shop up on blocks out back with a tortoise that lived underneath. Coaxing that tortoise out with lettuce took a lot of patience. The pattern on his shell looked like a quilt made of wood. He would munch the lettuce with no teeth, and my uncle would warn me not to get near his sharp beak with my fingers. I cannot recall the name of the tortoise, but I wonder if he is still alive. Uncle George was a baseball fan, a true blue Dodger fan. Being originally from New York, he was first a Brooklyn Dodger fan who was thrilled when the team moved to Los Angeles in the late 1950s. He used to say they followed their best fan west. He took me to a baseball game at the new Dodger Stadium, but first he taught me how to keep score. That was the prerequisite. Carnation ice cream in the cup with the little wooden spoon was my reward in the stands as we watched all our favorite players. On Saturdays, my uncle would pour an Olympia beer into a big cold frosted glass mug, shake salt into it, place it on a TV tray and say, "By George, that's beer." Then sit down in his favorite chair. I would watch the salt trickle down through the foam and settle to the bottom of the mug. I'd sit cross-legged on the floor, and we would listen to Vin Scully call the play-by-play. It was our summer tradition. Uncle George, in his gentle way, loved to tease me about being adopted.
You know, we found you under a rock.
You did not.
Well, then, we traded some outlaws for you.
No, you did not. It was a game we played, but sometimes my imagination would get the better of me. He would start in again whenever I had a loose tooth.
Fay, give me the string so I can tie it around her tooth.
He would smile, looking directly at me, and tell me not to worry because he would tie the other end of the string around a doorknob. I asked him the same question I had asked so many times before.
Then what?
I'll just slam the door, and you can put your tooth under the pillow before you go to sleep.
Uncle George spoke the truth. The tooth fairy was consistent and always left a new silver quarter under my pillow. I can't say I could always time losing a tooth in Southgate, but I tried my best to get one ready. Aunt Fay was not a big baseball fan. Her preference was basketball. She was a Lakers fan extraordinaire and never missed a game. During the playoffs, if the big TV in the living room was taken, she would sit in the kitchen with her little TV, watch the game, and smoke cigarettes, nervously tapping her fingers on the table when the Lakers were behind. Tap, tap, tap. That's all the time we have for today's broadcast. Join me on the next program, Part 4, for the continuation of Late for the Bus, an adoption story by Lee Close, author of the book and also your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.